Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Religious Liberties Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, April 15, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss the state of religious liberty in the armed services. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome today Michael Berry. He's the Senior Counsel and Director of Military Affairs at the First Liberty Institute. His bio was provided to you in advance of the call in the materials, and it's also available on our website, so I'm going to stop there with the introduction and leave more time for his opening remarks, which should go about 10 to 15 minutes. But as always, we'll be looking to you for questions. With that, Mr. Berry, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to participate, and hopefully this will be informative and interesting. I'd like to begin just by quickly explaining how I came to be a military religious liberties attorney after spending almost 8 years on active duty in the U.S. Marine Corps as an attorney, as a judge advocate in the Marines. I knew that I had a strong desire to continue supporting, upholding, and defending the U.S. Constitution, but I felt that I should begin doing so in a different phase of life. And so now, as a religious liberties attorney, I feel that I'm still defending the Constitution. I'm just not wearing a military uniform as I do so. And I did not expect that when I joined First Liberty Institute that I would be thrust into the world of having to defend service members, really the area of life that I had just left, thinking I was going into civilian practice. But nevertheless, I quickly learned that our people in our military are facing threats to religious freedom, really at the same level, same frequency, and same severity as we see it in civilian life. And I'd like to just briefly today discuss a few of the cases that First Liberty has that really touch on the issue of religious freedom in our military and for our service members. The first one that I would like to discuss is the case of United States Navy Chaplain Wes Motter. And some of you may be familiar with the case based on media reports. It got quite a bit of national media attention, and we really fully expected the case to go into litigation and result in a good published opinion. But as I'll explain in just a few moments, it ended up resolving itself before we got into court. So a quick, brief background on Chaplain Motter. He is a 19-and-a-half-year veteran at the time of that the incident occurred, having previously been an enlisted Marine and then switched to become a Navy chaplain probably 15 years ago or so. And so if you add up his Marine Corps time and his Navy time, he had about 19-and-a-half years of service under his belt. And as many probably are aware, once you hit 20 years in the military, your pension vests, your retirement vests, and you are in, you know, relatively safe when it comes to if something were to happen and you had to leave the military, your pension would have vested. But prior to that, all bets are off. And Chaplain Motter is endorsed by the Assemblies of God. And the Assemblies of God is one of the main denominations that sends people to become military chaplains. And in the military, when you're a chaplain, I like to tell people they kind of serve, our military chaplains serve two masters. First, they obviously must, when it comes to their military duties, must follow the lawful orders and directives of their military commanders. But when it comes to their religious duties, they are bound to follow the tenets of their endorsing denomination. In this case, with Chaplain Motter, it would be the tenets of the Assemblies of God. And one of the duties that chaplains perform that's one of their religious duties, I guess you could say it was concomitant with his military duties as well, but one of his religious duties was to provide pastoral counseling. This is when somebody would go to a chaplain and say, I would like some private counseling, it's confidential, and they can really, talk about whatever issues may be they may be facing at that time, and hopefully the chaplain can help them. So this is pastoral counseling and care is what they call it. And during that time, Chaplain Motter was asked fairly personal questions about faith, family, what does the Bible say about life and death, does God exist, those types of questions that you might expect from somebody in their early 20s asking an ordained minister. And Chaplain Motter answered in accordance with the teachings and tenets of his denomination, as he's required to do. Well, lo and behold, a couple of those service members complained that the answers that Chaplain Motter gave were what they perceived to be offensive or not tolerant of other worldviews or other lifestyles. And to make a long story short, in the interest of time, that led to Chaplain Motter's commanding officer requesting that he be what's called detached for cause, which would be the equivalent of being really kind of fired from your job, and then more severely, involuntarily removed from the Navy under what's called a board of inquiry. So that's where you are forcibly removed from the Navy, and that's what would have potentially led to him losing his pension. We fought this pretty much every step of the way on behalf of Chaplain Motter, beginning with his commanding officer. We didn't feel that we were going to get much relief there, which turned out to be correct, and it went to a one-star admiral. We thought that we might have a chance to get relief with the one-star admiral. It ended up being basically a rubber stamp, and it went to a two-star admiral. And that's where we thought, well, if it was a rubber stamp with the one-star admiral, it's going to be a rubber stamp with the two-star admiral. But to our surprise, we were pleasantly surprised to find out that the two-star admiral accepted all of our legal arguments and essentially overturned and rejected all of the threatened punishment against Chaplain Motter. The legal arguments really, which is why most people are interested in this, were that, in our military, we have RFRA, first of all, applies to all service members because RFRA, obviously, federal RFRA I'm referring to, applies to the federal government, including our Department of Defense. So we argued RFRA. We also argued that the Navy was not following its own regulations or Department of Defense regulations, and that's because in 2014, in January of 2014, the Department of Defense revised its regulations to explicitly incorporate by reference the Religious Freedom Restoration Act as a governing reference for the military. And it had happened, in 2014, like I said. So my suspicion is that many of the kind of lower level leaders in the military were not aware that had happened, and they were relying on old, outdated regulations, which did not incorporate the RFRA into military regulations. And that's really one of the main problems that we see in the military, is that you have at a very high level perhaps an understanding, even a respect for religious freedom that is embodied in regulations that doesn't necessarily trickle down to the lower levels. We're finally able to get somebody to take an honest look at our arguments, our RFRA arguments, our regulatory arguments, saying that RFRA clearly applies here. What you're doing is a violation of RFRA and violation of your own regulations, perhaps leading, conceivably to an APA violation or something like that, Administrative Procedures Act, and so on down the line. And finally, we were able to get relief for Chaplain Motter. And I'm happy to say that he's been fully restored in terms of back to full service. He was actually given a choice of where he wanted to move next, and I don't blame him. He chose San Diego, California, and so he's getting ready to retire here at the end of this year. So that's really a positive ending to what was a very tumultuous time for him in his life. I'd like to quickly change gears to talk about another military case that we have. This one is in the court system. In fact, we'll be having oral argument on this case on April 27th. This is an important case that we believe will be precedent setting and historic. And this is the case of United States versus Sterling, specifically Lance Corporal Monifa Sterling, who is a United States Marine who was court-martialed, which is a criminal proceeding, a federal criminal proceeding in the military. So she was court-martialed and convicted at her court-martial because she failed to remove a Bible verse that she had taped to her computer monitor in her workspace. And in her defense, she initially proceeded to defend herself pro se, and at trial she raised the fact that she felt that she was being targeted specifically because of her religious beliefs. And she introduced at trial the aforementioned DOD regulation that explicitly incorporates RFRA to the military. which I thought was fascinating that she had the foresight and the wherewithal to do that, which especially as a pro se litigant, but she did. And the judge actually said that he did not feel that RFRA was applicable to her case and therefore ruled against her. Nevertheless, she was able to preserve that as an appellate issue. She was convicted, as I mentioned. It went up to the first level of appeal, which is the Navy and Marine Corps Court of Criminal Appeals. At this point, First Liberty was still not representing Lance Corporal Sterling. She was represented by her military counsel at this point, but they picked up on the fact that she had raised RFRA. So they again, having the issue preserved, they raised RFRA on appeal. The Court of Criminal Appeals ruled in against her, and in its ruling, in its decision, it stated that RFRA did not apply in this case because posting a Bible verse to your computer workstation was not, in their opinion, a religious exercise. The reason it was not a religious exercise is because displaying Bible verses, in their opinion, was not central to a religious system of belief. So they went to the unfavored, you know, centrality analysis or centrality argument or centrality test, which is inappropriate for cases like this. And so they once again declined to apply RFRA to her case. Well, at this point, First Liberty got involved. We began representing her, and we appealed her case to the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, which is the highest court in the military. It's one step below. It's the equivalent of a federal circuit court, basically. And they have discretionary review, and so not every case that's brought before them is going to be reviewed. And we had to petition them to review the case. And in order to do so, we felt that we needed some outside assistance. So we brought in as lead counsel Mr. Paul Clement, former Solicitor General of the United States. And thankfully, the court agreed to take the case on that issue, the granted issue of whether or not the lower court erred in refusing and failing to apply RFRA. And that case will be argued on April the 27th. And as I said, I believe that the United States versus Sterling case will be one of historic precedent because it is, to everybody I've spoken with, including myself, to our knowledge, the first case of its kind before this military court that will address the nature and scope of RFRA's applicability to service members across all branches of the military. So this stands to be a very important case. There were a lot of amicus briefs submitted, I believe 13, if I recall correctly, anything from members of Congress. There are 43 members of Congress. We had retired general officers submit an amicus brief. Religious leaders across a multitude of faith groups submitted amicus briefs, all in favor of Lance Corporal Sterling and the inappropriate ruling below saying that RFRA did not apply to her. So those are just two of the highlights of current or very recent cases that First Liberty has dealing with religious liberty in the military. And to really to conclude my opening remarks, the reason I think these cases are important, the reason I think this issue is important is because religious freedom really is our first freedom in this country, embodied in the First Amendment to our Constitution. And religious freedom is vital to a strong military. The ability of our service members to express their faith openly without fear or intimidation. And I speak to this from personal experience as a veteran myself. It's really what enables the military service member to withstand the rigors of military life, the constant moving, the uncertainty, et cetera, and even the horrors of combat. I'm proud to stand with people in our military in defending religious freedom, and I'm proud to be First Liberty Institute's Director of Military Affairs. And with that, I conclude my opening remarks, and I would be happy to answer any questions that anybody has about any of those cases or anything else for that matter.
Well, thank you very much. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, you'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We're getting quite a few questions here, but before we take our first caller, let me mention our upcoming schedule. Next week, we've got a pretty good slate of calls. beginning Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time with a Courthouse Steps discussion of the Texas immigration case with Josh Blackman. This is the case, I think everybody knows, concerning the president's executive actions on immigration challenged by Texas, and this is the case in which the court has itself added the question about the Take Care Clause, so it should be an interesting discussion. That's Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Wednesday, we'll be talking about affirmative action in housing, Wednesday at 3, and then Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, some fascinating developments in the world of Bitcoin. So Monday, Wednesday, Friday next week so far. But check the calendar on our website and watch your emails for additions or changes to that schedule. Today we've got three callers with questions. We'll take them in order. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first call.
Good afternoon. Kevin Evan White calling from Chicago, and I would thank you very much for your presentation and for your service. I am involved in some of the RFRA cases pending here in the Northern District of Illinois, not involving the military. I was very curious about what governs the resolution of these cases prior to RFRA. I'm very surprised to learn that without RFRA, these cases would have probably gone very differently.
Yes, I absolutely think that, in fact, going back to prior to 93, so prior to the passage of RFRA, that was before my time in the military, but there were quite a few cases in which it was really unclear as to which way the court would go on any particular case, because there were cases dealing with religious exercise or religious expression in which the court ruled in favor of protecting that religious exercise and expression, and there were some that went against it. But I would say, interestingly, and somewhat, it was pre-93, but not that long ago, was an early 80s case that was in the Second Circuit called Katkoff versus Marsh. And that was a case in which some plaintiffs challenged the constitutionality of the Army's chaplaincy, just the actual existence of the chaplaincy under the Establishment Clause, as being a violation of the Establishment Clause simply because it was the funding of religion. And the court, interestingly, in Katkoff, the Second Circuit said, you know, that argument actually makes a lot of sense, that yes, that actually is the establishment of religion. But interestingly, the court said that, however, the military is different. The military is unique, and that because of that uniqueness, for example, the fact that the average service member can't, especially if they're stationed overseas or if they're deployed in an austere environment, they can't simply walk down the street to their nearest temple, synagogue, church, etc., to worship freely. And so because of that, and because Congress has the constitutional mandate to raise and fund an army, they also have the constitutional mandate to provide for the free exercise of those who are serving in the army. And this was in a post-conscription period. This was, I want to say it was 82 or 83 when the court said this. And it said, so, under that rubric, the fact that the Congress raises and supports these armies, the Congress also has this constitutional obligation to provide for free exercise for service members. And so because of that, this unique nature of the military, they said that the funding of religion and the establishment, therefore, of religion by Congress was constitutional under Katkoff versus Marsh. But then you look at other cases, a big one, which wasn't necessarily a pure free exercise case, but had a lot of overlap or at least a lot of parallels, Parker versus Levy. I'm sorry, the name slipped my mind for a minute. But in Parker, the Supreme Court said pretty much the opposite, but for very much the same reasons. And Parker was a case involving somebody during the Vietnam War who was engaging in speech that the military frowned upon. So we can certainly think of some parallels with religious speech, specifically the Chaplain Motter case, the Monifa Sterling case, for example. And the military said, well, we don't like that. And the person said, well, I have the First Amendment right to engage in this speech. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, well, no, because of the unique nature of the military, much like the Second Circuit said in Katkoff, Because of the unique nature of the military, you have what would normally be permitted or protected in civilian life may not be necessarily so in the military. So I think those are just two examples off the top of my head where it was difficult to tell which way a certain case was going to turn out prior to RFRA. And so now that we have RFRA on the books, and I want to be very clear, one of the things I continue to tell people is, and especially critics of RFRA or critics of cases invoking RFRA, RFRA doesn't guarantee outcomes. RFRA merely guarantees a process, a procedure that will be followed. And that's all we're asking in the case, especially like United States versus Sterling. We're not saying that RFRA dictates a particular outcome here. We're simply saying that RFRA guarantees a certain form of due process that will be applied to service members and that the court failed to apply that. And that's really all we're asking for.
Thank you very much.
Once again, we've got one question pending. Before we take another question, let me announce, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask a question, if I could, Mike, about the application of RFRA in a military context. That test, talks about compelling government interest and using the least restrictive means possible, I think is the language. Are those standards different within a military environment? I mean, is it easier to prove a compelling government interest in a military environment than in a civilian environment?
That's a great question. I, from a practical point of view, I think it is a little bit easier in the military environment. And I'll give a case, for example. The case was a Ninth Circuit case called Sherbert versus Brown. This was a pre-RFRA case. However, it was a case in which the court applied strict scrutiny, which is the test that you just explained, right? The compelling government interest, least restrictive means. And in Sherbert versus Brown, the plaintiff in that case was somebody who had converted. It was a Navy a sailor who had converted to Sikhism and wanted to grow his hair long and had to wear a head covering. We've seen actually quite a few articles in the media about Sikhs being granted religious accommodations to do just that. Well, this was back in the 70s, and Mr. Sherwood was stationed. He was in the Navy. He was stationed aboard an aircraft carrier, and he was actually working around the jets and the jet engines. And of course, there's with those turbine engines and whatnot, there's a lot of they take a lot of precautions to ensure there's no debris, no foreign objects that can get sucked into the engines. And with long hair, he couldn't properly fit into a helmet, but he sought this accommodation to grow his hair long anyway because of his religious beliefs. It went all the way to the Ninth Circuit. Because the Navy said no, we can't let you do that, and they cited safety concerns as being the number one reason why, and also uniformity of appearance and grooming standards as kind of a backup reason. And the Ninth Circuit applied strict scrutiny, and they said yes, this would substantially burden Sherwood's religious exercise. But in this case, we believe that the government does have a compelling interest in safety on the flight line. We can't have objects being sucked into jet engines, least of all somebody's hair. And so in that case, the Navy won that case. And so it's because of things like that, like the safety issue, the uniformity standards, the need for, as the Parker versus Levy court said, the need for good order and discipline and for commanders to be able to enforce good order and discipline within their units. Those are the types of factors that I think would actually make it more likely that the military would prevail, that the government would prevail in defending against a RFRA claim than you might find in the non-military context.
We've got two questions pending, so let's go to another caller now.
Okay.
This is David Applegate with the Chicago Lawyers Chapter. By way of background, I'm once known in the trade as an Air Force brat. Both my parents are buried today at Arlington National Cemetery. When my father passed in 1993, essentially the choices on the headstone were a Christian cross or the Star of David. When my mother was interred 20 years later, the cemetery gave us about 44 choices, I think, including the Hammer of Thor, Wiccan symbol, something for secular humanists, I think just about everything but a Nazi swastika. My understanding is that at the Air Force Academy today, somewhere up on the mountain, to accommodate those who do not choose to attend services at the United States Air Force Academy Chapel, which is world-renowned for its architecture, among other things, its beauty and its grace, there is some sort of Wiccan circle where cadets can gather at midnight and howl at the moon as such. Given that the armed forces have gone to such extraordinary lengths to accommodate every possible belief system, how can we regard cases such as the ones you described, sir, in your opening remarks, as anything other than a crusade against Christianity? And I ask that speaking as an agnostic. So I deeply respect the religious beliefs of anyone, so not long as those beliefs do not require them personally to kill me. But it seems to me that this is a very one-sided battle by the government against a particular one of the Abrahamic faiths.
Well, I think I have two responses to that, which I hope will at least provide some insight. I think, well, first is not necessarily a response, but maybe more of a disclaimer, is that my organization, First Liberty Institute, our mission is to defend religious liberty for all Americans, and that means all Americans of any faith. And
I
so,
understand and support that.
Yeah, and the rationale for that, which I think ties into what you're asking about, is that if we support, so let's use the example that I just brought up from recent headlines, a Sikh member of the armed forces who's seeking it, who's asking for a religious accommodation to wear long hair with an appropriate head covering, to grow a beard, etc. And the view of our organization, and my personal view, is that if the armed forces accommodates that Sikh soldier and protects the religious freedom, the right of conscience, the right of free expression of that Sikh soldier, then that is good for all religious faiths, all faith groups, because what's good for protecting religious freedom for one group is protecting religious freedom for all groups. And so because of that, I would actually support the right of somebody to have a something other than a cross or a Star of David on their headstone in a military ceremony, cemetery, excuse me.
As do I.
And so, but to answer your question, I think, and our organization does a lot of research into this. Number one, our military is, by and large, continues to be a Christian military. They still comprise the vast majority, a supermajority of members of our military happen to be members of the Christian faith, whether that be Catholic or Protestant or any denomination they're under. So just in terms of sheer numbers, they are more likely to become targets of religious hostility than any other, purely because of just statistical probability. And then that really ties into the fact that, or I think it provides a statistical explanation as for why we see more people of the Christian faith or perhaps even Judeo-Christian faiths appear to be the targets of religious hostility than any other group. And I think there's a second reason for that too, is you have some advocates who are anti-religious freedom advocates, is how I would generally categorize them, who we have on record, going on record. I testified, I wouldn't say against, but testified alongside one of them in a House Armed Services Committee hearing in 2014, who was on record as saying what we have seen historically is Christians have had, basically their seat at the table has been too prominent, and it's time for them to step aside and really let others have a more prominent seat at the table. And the phrase he used is what he wants to see, a reversal of Christian privilege in the military. And so if that's the case, and if the government is buying into that argument, then it might not simply be a matter of statistical probability. It might actually be a form of targeting, because in some sort of weird framework where they've decided We've been too Christian in the past, and so now we need to shift the pendulum to the other side so that other groups can have more influence and power. I hope that's not the case. Obviously, I don't have any actual evidence of that other than an advocate claiming that that's what they want to see. But beyond that, obviously, I highly doubt I would ever find, you know, an official from the Department of Defense saying, yes, that's what we're doing.
Well, thank you, sir, for the highly insightful remarks. And thank you also, sir, for your service.
Oh, thank you very much.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a few minutes left and just one question pending. So let's take this next call.
Hi, this is Ken Masugi from the Washington, D.C. chapter. I know a priest here in the area, Father Vincent Rigdon, who wound up suing the government while he was a chaplain in the Air Force, and he won his case. And basically, this is back in the 1990s, and the Catholic Church had asked priests to contact to speak to their parishioners about partial birth abortion and the need to reinforce support the ban on it.
Yes, that's a very famous case.
Right, and Father Rigdon, whom I spoke with, said that as far as he knew, it was never appealed. But I don't know. But he said he hadn't kept up with it. So, can you enlighten us on the status of that?
Yeah. So this was the case. Like as I mentioned, it's at least well known in my circles. It's the case of Rigdon versus Perry, and it was decided at the D.C. District Court. And that's correct. It's never gone beyond that, which I think is good in this case because of the outcome. And really, the Rigdon versus Perry case, as you mentioned, was a case where Catholic priests, the Catholic Church, was encouraging its priests to encourage their parishioners to support the ban on partial birth abortion. This was back in the early 90s when that was a very hot button political issue. The United States Air Force told its chaplains, "You cannot speak on that, even from your military chapel pulpit, because you're crossing the line into advocating for legislation. You're getting into political issues, etc." Father Rigdon said, "I believe this is a matter of interest to the church. This is a religious issue. I should have the right to speak on it." And the result of Rigdon versus Perry, which is very interesting. It's a case in which I now colloquially refer to as the two collars case, because what came out of that is something that we actually I've had the privilege and the fortune of teaching at the Naval Academy previously. And when I was a professor at the Naval Academy, I would explain to the midshipmen when we would end up talking about First Amendment and free exercise and the Establishment Clause, and the question would inevitably arise: well, what about chaplains? Did rules apply differently to them? And to a certain degree, they do. And here's how. It's based on Rigdon versus Perry. So I mentioned before that chaplains kind of serve two masters, if you will. And the embodiment of that would be their collar. On their uniform collar, they wear two rank insignia. On one collar, they wear their military rank insignia. And on their other collar, they wear their service device insignia, which in the case of a chaplain is the insignia that represents their faith group. So if they're a Catholic priest like Father Rigdon, they would wear a cross. And when Father Rigdon was in any chaplain, when they're performing their military duties, if they're attending a staff meeting, if they are watching a military parade, if whatever it might be, if it's a purely military function, and they are speaking to somebody, then they would address them and that person would be addressed by their military rank. So I can't recall Father Rigdon's rank, but let's say he was a major. Okay, a lieutenant colonel. You would address him as Lieutenant Colonel Rigdon if it was a purely military ceremony. Now, obviously, if you become friends with somebody and acquaintances, you might, in the military we often have these, you might hear them referred to as Padre or Father or whatnot or Chaps. as a common one. But if it's more formal and if it's in a military environment, you would refer to them by their rank, and they would be expected to afford the appropriate military customs and courtesies. Now, if Father Rigdon is speaking from the pulpit, he is speaking from the other collar. He is speaking from the side of the collar with his Christian cross insignia. And what the court said is, when a chaplain is speaking from the side of the collar that has the military rank insignia, then their speech is subject to the same rules and regulations as anybody else in the military under Parker versus Levy, that they can be held accountable under good order and discipline, etc. But when the chaplain is speaking from the religious side of the collar, when they're speaking from the pulpit or they are engaging in what is clearly religious speech pursuant to their religious duties, then their speech is protected under the First Amendment as religious speech to the same degree that it would be as if they were a citizen, a civilian speaking, engaging in religious speech. So it was a very interesting opinion, creating that dichotomy for chaplains. And so that was kind of the result of Rigdon versus Perry, which in essence protected religious speech by religious members of the military, namely chaplains, but also kind of preserving the good order and discipline, the military readiness, et cetera. They tried not to disturb that balance too much. And so I think that might be one of the reasons why the Air Force and the DOJ decided not to appeal that beyond the D.C. District Court. But nevertheless, I hope that provides some insight and answers your question.
Oh, thank you very much.
We've got another question. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone.
Yes. David Emerson with the San Francisco chapter. First, thanks to the speaker, and thanks for all your good efforts. My question has to do with the excessive entanglement aspect of these cases. And I'd like to get the speaker's thoughts on, in particular, I think one of the cases you mentioned was the display of the Bible verse in the workplace. But I can see it could be applied in a lot of other cases as well, where it may just be an argument that just a blanket prohibition avoids the excessive entanglement of going in and determining, you know, exactly what manner, shape, and form a verse can be displayed in the workplace. But and also, so in addition to that, is there any kind of sense that you have that excessive entanglement is regarded somewhat differently in the military context than the civilian?
I'll answer those in reverse. I haven't necessarily observed or picked up that the excessive entanglement aspect is more problematic or more pervasive in the military than in the civilian context. That's the first part. And the second part is, yes, you're correct that just as with any other governmental entity, this military commander, typically this is delegated to an individual unit commander's discretion, certainly has the discretion and the authority to implement a policy that says, for example, this is a fairly common one, it is probably ubiquitous throughout the military, that says, email signature lines that people like to put underneath their at the bottom of their email signature block, no personalized signature blocks. So as long as that's applied uniformly, then that would be a perfectly legitimate exercise of command discretion and authority. And that would also include no religious taglines. Many people in the military, if their command allows it, will have a Bible verse quoted or some inspirational saying or of some kind. But others may have, go New England Patriots or something like that on there. Others may have some kind of Latin maxim that relates to military service. And so commanders, again, in their discretion, if they feel that allowing that would open up the possibility for too much entanglement and too many issues, the way to avoid viewpoint discrimination is to say it's really all or nothing. So many of them will say, my policy is that I don't allow any of it. You could do the same with displaying things in your workspace, displaying things on your computer. And therein lies one of the problems inherent to the United States versus Sterling situation, is that one of the things that Lance Corporal Sterling pointed out at trial was that there were others in the workspace working in the same area as her who were permitted to display pretty much whatever they wanted, as long as it wasn't, obscenity or something like that or nudity, but they were allowed to display their own personal messages. when she sought to display hers, hers was targeted for removal because of its religious nature. And so that obviously would be a form of viewpoint discrimination. It's unlawful, unconstitutional, et cetera. And so that's where the problem lies in many of these, is that even if you have a uniform policy, it's not being applied uniformly.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are open. We've still got some time left. While we wait to see if somebody else rings in, let me ask a question or two, if I could. You mentioned that RFRA is incorporated in your first case, and presumably in the second case, through a Department of Defense regulation. RFRA, by its own terms, the statute doesn't apply to the Department of Defense, I take it. Is there anything that prevents the Department of Defense reversing that regulation, you know, going through notice and comment and doing what it needs to do to promulgate a regulation? And as a corollary to that question, are there any recent developments or any legislative developments in the offing that might impose RFRA or impose some other standards in the military capacity?
Well, so first, no, there's nothing. That's quite a scary proposition you made, that no, there's nothing to prevent the Department of Defense. I mean, the next Secretary of Defense, presumably, you know, whoever is elected president in November would choose a new Secretary of Defense, is free to direct, you know, a revision of that regulation. Now, you also ask whether RFRA is explicitly applied to the military by its own terms, and the answer to that is no, not within the actual text of the statute. However, there is some legislative history that clearly indicates that Congress intended for RFRA to apply to the military. Both the House and Senate Judiciary Committee's reports on RFRA make very clear that, for example, in the House committee report said, I'm trying to remember the exact wording, but I'll probably paraphrase, that, you know, courts must review claims of military personnel under the compelling governmental interest test, which, you know, basically is saying this is the test that also applies to the military and military personnel. So by its own terms, no, but certainly within the legislative history, it's intended to apply to the military, and I don't think anybody would make a straight-faced argument that RFRA somehow should not apply to the military. And to answer your last question about any recent developments, yes, interestingly, not only did the Department of Defense, well, the reason why the Department of Defense revised its regulations in January of 2014 was in response to directives by Congress to do so. And those directives really started back in the Fiscal Year 13 National Defense Authorization Act, when there was a push to incorporate conscience protections specifically for chaplains. It specifically mentions chaplains in the military may not be required to perform any rite, ritual, or ceremony that is contrary to their conscience, moral principles, or religious beliefs, or nor can there be any adverse action taken against a chaplain who refuses to perform a rite, ritual, or ceremony contrary to their beliefs. So that was FY13, and it was relatively well received. Like, you know, it made sense. You shouldn't require a chaplain to do something that violates their religious beliefs, especially under threat of punishment or adverse action by a military commander. And so in 2014, we basically got a second bite at the apple with Congress, and they actually added some amendments to the 2013 provision. And so in the FY 2014 National Defense Authorization Act, Congress added some additional protection that expanded beyond merely chaplains, but really to any member of the military. And so the new provision says that unless it would have an adverse impact on military readiness, good order and discipline, mission accomplishment, that the military should accommodate, it shall accommodate individual expressions of religious belief based on sincerely held beliefs, conscience, moral principles, etc. So, you know, what started in FY13 as protection for conscience protections for chaplains expanded in 2014 to really all members of the military, unless, and with that one caveat that unless the military could show that this would somehow detract against, you know, from the mission or good order and discipline, that it would apply across the board. And then they added in there, oh, by the way, the Secretary of Defense should prescribe implementing and promulgating regulations to be consistent with this. So that was really the catalyst and the impetus for that change in 2014 to the DoD regulation. So that's really how that came about.
We do have another listener question, so let's take another call now.
Good afternoon, Mr. Berry. This is Brian Duff from the Ohio State Student Chapter. I was just thinking about the some of the content restrictions that military chaplains face in their command function prayers or public prayers, where they're, you know, instructed to be non-sectarian at least in the content of those prayers, and whether or not a policy or an instruction like that would survive a challenge under Tanif Greece, for instance, which looked pretty negatively against content restrictions and public prayers.
That's a fascinating question. I don't think that's one that has necessarily been analyzed comprehensively yet. This is kind of the tension between Town of Greece and Rigdon versus Perry. I don't think there necessarily is overt tension between the two, but there certainly is some implicit tension. And by that I mean, so under Rigdon versus Perry, anything that a chaplain says pursuant to their religious duties is protected. But if what they do according to their military duties may not necessarily have the same degree of protection under the First Amendment. How that applies to the scenario you laid out, which is chaplains, let's just say offering an invocation or a benediction. If the event is explicitly religious in nature, or inherently religious in nature, then the chaplain is probably and should be free to conclude that prayer in the manner of their own choosing, in accordance with their religious faith or religious beliefs. If that event is more of a, if it looks a lot more like a military event, if it's a parade ceremony, a change of command ceremony, or something like that, then it might be the commander might have more leeway or discretion to say, hey, chaplain, I would prefer if you not end the prayer, you know, in Jesus' name, for example. And we've seen certainly instances of that happening in our military. And so that's what I've been telling chaplains who ask me that question is, if it looks and feels like a military ceremony, then you probably should go with what your commander says. If it's a religious ceremony, then then you certainly have a much greater argument that what you say is protected. What's interesting and what you brought up was Town of Greece. Does Town of Greece turn that on its head? All right, and the portion of Town of Greece specifically we're referring to is the part where the court said that it's inappropriate really for courts to be delving into the content of prayer to determine whether something is too religious or not religious enough to satisfy, to pass muster, so to speak. So I think that's interesting, and honestly, I haven't done enough research on it on my own or surveyed the academic landscape to see whether anybody's written on that yet. I certainly think it's worth looking into, though.
Well, Mr. Berry, it looks like we have taken our final question of the day. Let me come back to you one last time and give you a chance to wrap up or express any thoughts you might have. And in doing that, let me ask you, I think you mentioned that in your second case, U.S. v. Sterling, you're in the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces with Paul Clement. Is there an appeal from there into the civilian court system, or is that where this ends, that is U.S. versus Sterling?
The Supreme Court of the United States has jurisdiction over cases before that came through the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. So conceivably, if we do not prevail here, yes, we could petition the U.S. Supreme Court. Obviously, we know what the odds are of a cert grant there, but obviously we would prefer to win here and now, but that doesn't mean that that's not a possibility if we don't get a favorable result.
Any final thought before we adjourn?
Just that I thank the questioners and the audience profusely for their participation. The questions show, obviously, people were understand the issues and some of the problems underlying religious freedom in the military. And so I'm glad to see that literally from coast to coast, we had Washington, D.C. to San Francisco, people are care about this issue, as do I. People are paying attention to what's happening out there. And so for that, I'm greatly appreciative and hope to meet all of you in person someday.
Well, Michael Berry, thank you very much. We certainly appreciate it. And let me thank you for your service as well, as some of the callers did. I also want to thank our callers for joining us today and for your thoughtful questions. A reminder that our next scheduled call will discuss the Texas immigration case being argued in the court on Monday. Our call is at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. But until that next scheduled telephone conference call, we're adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.